This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
Well, happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We've made it around the world one more time. I cannot believe it, but November is almost gone. We are creeping into December, and before you know it, we are going to be looking at a new year. Turkey season is going to be here. Good fishing in Florida is had all through the winter. You just have to kind of shift your focus. And if you like red fishing, the coast right now is on fire. This intro is going to sound a little different because I'm recording this one on the road. We've had a lot of problems with our RSS feed. And one of the feedback mechanisms was that I needed to re-edit them and upload them in a different format. So here we are. I don't have a mic on me, but I just want to wish each and every one of you guys a happy Thanksgiving. One of the things we are most grateful for is the amount of people that for some reason continue to turn in week to week and listen to us. This is a fun podcast, and I hope you guys enjoy it. It's 2 hours long, and I shot for a longer podcast because everybody's traveling this week, and I kind of hoped that you guys would enjoy having the longer format. We are going to go all over the world with a Florida cracker, a good old Florida boy, and who has an amazing story. And I know you guys are going to enjoy it. And we got a bunch of other stuff coming. I got a deer report that's editing and going to be uploaded shortly. And hopefully the powers that be can get our RSS feed a little more reliable. We can get some more content out to you guys. But we got another video drop in tonight or tomorrow on the YouTube channel as well, so you can go over there and check that out. If you'd like to sign up for Patreon, patreon.com/chasingtailsoutdoors. The money from that goes directly towards the expansion of the show, new camera gear, new states, new stuff, we appreciate each and every one of you guys. And so check the website. There's something really cool coming down the pipe I think you guys are really going to like, so I'm not going to spill the beans there, but we're going to have a really awesome Black Friday sale that you're going to want to jump on. So be watching the website, enjoy this episode, and we will see you on the other side. Ladies and gentlemen, this is one of those episodes where you look forward to recording it for months on end. I've had the privilege of speaking with this fella for years now. 2016 or 17 was the first time that I talked to this fella, and he remembered where I worked. He remembered I was in grad school after years of not having talked to him, which lended, I think, itself to his career that we'll talk about here in a little bit, lended itself well to that. And this fella, I feel like, has opened up a whole array of outdoor activities that without the product that he has, you would find yourself severely limited. I find myself currently severely limited. And one of the reasons why I wanted to have him on is because I'm moving the direction of what he already has. I have questions. We've talked about this in the Marco Polo group, which is, as you guys know, where we get a lot of our podcast ideas, topics that swirl around there, finally, you know, find their way to the podcast. So I have got the legend. I mean, this fella is a household name in Florida. He's smiling. John Dobbs, buddy. Man, so here's the deal. This is part two. We tried to record this the first time. It failed miserably. I had to run right out the door to a family emergency. I want to say thank you for constantly working with my crazy schedule and coming on for a second go.
Hey, brother. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be a part of it. And really looking forward to chatting.
Yeah, no, this is going to be really fun. There's, I don't know that you could, when we were talking before we hit record about the different things we wanted to hit, the different topics, all too often you find yourself constrained, and this is why we'd love to have people on for part two, part three, to dive down into like nuanced material, because you have too much to talk about. I don't know that we've ever had a buffet of topics from one guest like we're going to have with you. I mean, your history in the outdoors is just awesome. So why don't you give everybody kind of the elevator pitch as to who you are, the company that you run, and then we'll kind of bounce around. We got a bunch of stuff we want to talk about.
Okay. Well, I guess I would have to back up to where I'm from. I grew up in the backwoods of the Ozark Mountains. I was born in the 60s, and back then things weren't near like they are today. Even there, we lived in the a log cabin that my great-great-grandfather had built. My parents put newspapers over the walls, and, you know, plastered the walls with newspapers to keep the to cover up the and they put siding on the outside to cover up those logs because it made it look respectable. But we had a hand-dug well out back. We had no running water in the house. We had an outhouse out back. And that was the Ozarks. I hunted and fished as a kid didn't really have any concept of game laws. I just wasn't aware of it. I was ignorant about that. It was total freedom. I could do whatever I wanted, hunting and fishing. And I didn't have any concept of a hunting lease because there was land everywhere, public land. But it was an idyllic way to grow up, you know, when it comes to the outdoors. I was just a backwoods kid. I give you an example of just how uneducated, I guess, I was of the world. I remember a bunch of other kids saying they were going to the Cal Smith show, I begged my mom. I wanted to go, and so she gave me the money to go to the show. And when I got there, it was a country and western singer, and his name was Cal Smith. I honestly thought, Walt, that I was going to see a blacksmith put horseshoes on a cow. COW, Cal Smith. But anyway, he sang that one hit wonder. I think it was 1974. Hello, Country Bumpkin. I didn't know he was singing to me.
Well, I can tell from your backdrop, your housing conditions have changed. You've got running water. It looks like you're doing well for yourself over there. Do you ever find yourself longing for those? Let me tell you, I grew up no public land, but I had free reign of all the land around me. It was all privately owned. I didn't know people had boundaries. Like, unless you had a fence up, I didn't know. And yeah, No one cared, you know, and I'll be honest with you. I kind of miss those days.
I do too. You know, we hunted on, you know, other land, adjoining farms and stuff, but
yeah,
I was from the mountain I'm from, that it was our last name, Dobbs Mountain. And so a lot of the people adjoining farms, they were relatives. So yeah, I didn't think about boundaries at all. You know, most of the boundaries were rock fences and stuff. You just climbed. Those are more innocent times for sure. Everybody I'm sure misses that, you know, what they can remember, what things used to be like. But you know, it's definitely changing, and you know, the resources are, you know, becoming more limited, and there's more people that are vying for them. So it's definitely something that you know, the mud motor business I've started helps in that regard, for people to access places where they're they can get to places that other people can't get to. So you can still find places that you have the whole place to yourself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're not, 40 yards away, and there's another guy sitting in a tree stand.
You know, it's funny. Also, the resources change. You know, if you look at a lot of these places, the Wasissa River, and pretty much any lake in Florida now is chock full of hydrilla, unless there's good water movement. You know, some of the places I hunted, there'll be old timers fishing out there, and they are just pissed that the place where they grew up, where all you had was lily pads and cattails, you know, you can't get outboards. You know, I was telling one guy where I deer hunted, and he's like, oh, I can't even get back there anymore. I'm gonna have to buy a mud motor, but I can't even fish it even if I got there. And I'm like, what you mean? He goes, dude, that was my fishing hole. Like that place way up that creek, that was my, I can't even, there's no way to fish it anymore because of all the hydrilla. And I'm like, you mean this wasn't here to begin with? He's like, nah, you know, like this is, this used to be a clear lake and, you know, deep holes and everything. And it just, it blows my mind. So, you know, I think there's a resource need there as well. You know, you've got all these invasive species that are just choking things out even more so. And so, you know, that's kind of what led me to you was I moved to Florida. I grew up in Southeast Georgia, where if you wanted to get somewhere, an outboard pretty much got you there. And you moved to Florida, and all the lakes and rivers here really, really don't want you back there.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like anything comes here from somewhere else, you know, it just thrives. It just takes off. And there's a lot of competing species and, you know, and it's both in the plant life and fish and wildlife as well. So, you know, we got our problems with our the hydrilla you mentioned, but also with the pythons down in the glades and you know, the peacock bass. You know, they're displacing other predators, but they're awful fun to catch. You know, they're one of the success stories of a foreign, you know, invading species.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, so I have to ask you this question. The lake and the mountainous area that the movie Ozark is, or the show Ozark is filmed on, is that Dobbs Mountain?
First, well, I don't watch TV.
Okay.
I've got a TV, but I don't turn it on. Hardly ever. If I do turn it on, it's to watch something on maybe YouTube or something. But, I have seen about like 10 minutes of the show Ozark, and that's, you know, it's nothing like the Ozarks, but but yeah, it's that changed a lot too, you know. Walton from Walmart, he was up in Bentonville, and one of my early jobs as a kid, you know, like real job, was I worked at Walmart store number 7. And back then, the furthest Walmart was Texas.
Wow.
And but he's done a lot, you know, that company has done a lot to really expand that part of the world up there. And it's built up quite a bit since then. But where I'm from is, if you looked at the Ozarks, there's an area where there's no highways. You got Highway 59 to the east. You got Highway 71 to the east, Highway 59 to the west, Highway 62 up above, and then you got I-4 down below. I think it's I-4. I-40. Anyway, there's a square there. I'm from right in the middle of that square where there's nothing. It's pretty remote country. Even today, the old road that goes up over the mountain there, it's still dirt.
Wow. Even today.
And, we have what they call low water bridges. Have you ever heard of that?
Nope.
It's basically just a shallow spot in a stream where you can drive across. Yeah. And, you know, bed. And but when you go up on the mountain, you could hear another car coming from a quarter mile away because all of the loose bolts and stuff on the bed, and, you know, the truck and everything be squeaking and popping and cracking, and you could hear people from way off.
That's awesome.
Rough roads, but They're still that way, thankfully. You know, last time I was back up there at the old family cemetery, those old roads are still like they were. It's changed.
That's so in Southeast Georgia, I grew up on Jekyll Island, St. Simon's Island area, right behind that. Yeah. And that area was where I grew up, and all the roads were dirt. I literally remember them paving the main road down further towards the house. And, it used to be one of those things when the weather was nice, you'd leave the windows open because you didn't want to pay for AC. It was expensive. And, you would hear crack pop, crack, 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 pop, crack, 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 pop. And you could hear somebody coming from like a quarter mile away, like you talked about, because we used to pave the roads with oyster shells. Yeah. And so you'd hear people coming kind of like you would gravel. And you just took me back when you said that. You just took me back, man. Because you'd be doing something. You'd be cleaning squirrels. You'd be cleaning fish. You'd be fixing a fence or something. You'd hear it, and everybody would just – it was like the entertainment of the moment. You'd be like, who's coming? Like, no one else is here, you know? Like, so
– that's some beautiful country up there where you're from. I love that area. I remember meeting a young kid up there one day that was fishing, and I could hardly understand him. And I'm from the South. Mm-hmm. His accent was so thick. But they got some good eating holes up there too, man. I went into this place one time with a buddy, and there were no pictures on the wall. Nothing like that. It was just, they were, if you came there, you were there to eat.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And it was a buffet, and they'd bring carts around with dessert and, you know, iced tea and,
yeah.
And what good food. That's one thing George is known for, is some of the best home cooking.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, I miss that Savannah area a lot. Savannah hasn't really changed, and you can go up there and it's tough, dude. It's tough because that little square that you talked about, it's gone. It's been developed. And so it's like, people are like, oh, you want to go back home? And it's like, not really. Home's gone, man. Like that area, they paved roads right smack dab through the pines, and it's subdivisions now. And so it's like, you know, I remember driving down one of the roads, and I kind of got lost for a second. I was like, I don't like this feeling. Like, I drove down this road my entire life, and I don't have any idea where I am.
Right. Yeah.
But that Savannah area, I love it, man. And the fishing up there, we went up there for a baptism last week, and we had like 2 hours to go fishing. Jumped in the boat, put it in, go out there, and we caught monster redfish. Just, you know, had a good time.
Yeah, that sawgrass and those old shrimp boats, man, that's just beautiful country around there.
Yep.
Yeah. Love to go up there.
Yeah. It's a great time. Well, so this begs the question, how in the heck did the lawless, or the law ignorant, I should say, not lawless, it wasn't intentional, Ozark boy find Florida?
Well, as a kid, I always loved to read.
Okay.
And I always, you know, when I bring my school books home with me, we lived on a farm, and I always brought a library book home with me as well. And the little lady that was our librarian at our local school, Beulah Bachman was her name, bless her heart. She just stocked those shelves with all manner of books about foreign places all over the world. And that's what, when I started learning, you know, about other places around the world. And when I was in the fourth grade, I read the book, The Yearling.
Mm-hmm.
By Marjorie Kenan Rawlings.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just, you know, learned that there was a place that was warm, you know, this boy that had a pet deer, and, you know, really a pit. And, when I think I was 17, I was laying underneath a 53 Studebaker, putting a clutch in it in the cold. I had coveralls on, it was frozen. You know, you ever been out working and your fingers, it's so cold that your fingers lose dexterity?
Yep.
And they hurt. Well, I was trying to put bolts in this bell housing, and I was laying there, and I said, you know, there's a better place than this. It's warm. I promised myself then, when I get out of high school, I'm headed to Florida. And I made good on it. The very following day after graduating, I was on the road down here. And, you know, I go back and visit, but I've been here ever since. I've lived here longer than I lived there. So I left there when I was 18, and I was just getting ready to turn 55. So I've been down here a while.
Okay. Now that begs the question, given that you've hit that point of you've been here longer, are you a Florida cracker or are you an Ozarks boy? What's home?
I'm a hybrid. I'm only a hillbilly.
Yeah.
But all of my friends, they're all, you know, they're all crackers. All of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I run with a pretty rough little crowd of boys. But they're all good folks, man. You can call them and they're there in a minute.
Yeah.
I remember coming back from, I was up to Cedar Key here a while back, and I got me a load of oysters, and I was coming back, and I threw a belt on my old GMC pickup, and I was sitting on the side of the road, and I actually posted up a picture. I said, "Note to self: if you break down on the side of the highway, make sure you have a bushel of Cedar Key oysters with you." And it wasn't even a minute. A buddy of mine calls me up. He goes, "Hey, you need help? I'm on the way." You know, and he's 100 miles away. He was ready to hook on a trailer and come get me.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's the kind of friends I have down here. So, you know, crackers are good folks.
Oh, yeah.
And where I'm from, people are, I don't know, they're a little more rough cut, a little more rough around the edges. Crackers are so polite down here. Where I'm from, that people will tell you exactly what they think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they just are unfiltered. Mm-hmm. Down here, it seems like the crackers I know, they will, they don't want to hurt your feelings. But not straight, you know?
Yeah.
That's one of the things that, you know, to get used to from the difference from out there and down here. But, yeah, I love all my buddies. They're good folks.
I spent my first half of my childhood in Slidell, Louisiana. And uh-huh. I never forget, you talked about how nice people are and how going out of their way. My dad, yeah. When I was a child, I never saw him. He worked so much. But every year we would make a squirrel palooza. We would go to Southeast Georgia for a long weekend, and we would shoot as many squirrels as we could. We made squirrel and rice and fried squirrel and everything, did that, had a good time. And I remember one day we left on a Thursday night. Dad was going to drive through the night so we could have our full 3 days over there. And yeah. Drove through the night. We got right across the bridge on Lake Pontchartrain, got to the far side, and all of a sudden you hear tire goes, and it's pouring down rain. I'm talking just raining cats and dogs, and pull off to the side of the road. I quit counting at 26. Now, I don't know if that's because I was too young to count past 26 or I just got tired of counting, but 26 trucks pulled off in front of us, backed up in the rain, hopped out and came to ask my dad if he needed help, because he's back there, you know, working on a Chevy Lumina. And I mean, the first one helped us, and we were off to the races, but it was just truck after truck after truck. And there's just something different about these deep South fellas. They're just a little yep. nicer, a little softer.
Yep. Yep.
You know? Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I love it down here. I wouldn't live anywhere else.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's good people in the South.
So you came down here. What'd you do? Because I know what you ended up doing, and I'm curious to see how you made the transition. And was it a transition you made because of your childhood of up in the Ozarks, or was it just to stay in the outdoors? Like, what was the motivator?
No, I just that country out there is I call it tooth and nail country, because it really is a tough place to heck out of living. There wasn't a lot of then. Now there's a lot more money out there, but back then there was none. I made money by hauling hay or I worked for a sorghum farmer, just whatever it was, seasonal. In the winter I trapped, and by the time I graduated high school I had $10,000 saved up, and that's a lot of possum hides, let me tell you.
Yeah,
but I ended up when I got down here, I wanted to go to college. So I went to USF and in Tampa. And I remember one day I was actually wanting to be an airline pilot. I was actually flying. I was doing my cross country solos and everything, and had everything out of the way, but my check ride. Then my flight instructor got killed in a crash, and he was a much better pilot than me. And that kind of, sure, and I also was running low on money. So, I was sitting on the causeway where the bridge was up one day, and there was a sailboat going through, and all of a sudden a patrol boat ran underneath the bridge, and I looked to my left as the patrol boat was driving away, and there was a guy wearing a gray uniform and a gun belt, and his name was Tim Erickson. I recognized, he's a great big Swede, and years later I got to meet him, but I immediately pointed at that boat and I said, "That is what I'm going to do." And it was just, it was a reflex. It was without hesitation. And from that moment forward, I completely shifted gears, and I started pursuing a career with the Florida Marine Patrol. So I applied to them. They took 5,000 applications. And they had physical assessments in Tallahassee and also another one in Tampa. Well, I went to the one in Tampa. And when I went to that physical assessment, there were a sea of people. And I remember Major Ken Thompson standing up on a platform addressing the crowd up on a high balcony. And he's got a megaphone so everybody can hear him. And he says, we're offering 40 positions.
Wow.
And I remember standing there and thinking, there ain't no way I'm going to get this job. 40 positions. Look at there's thousands here. Mm-hmm. And so I went through the physical assessment and passed that. And then they did interviews next. And I ended up passing that enough. So they narrowed it down. There was only a few hundred they brought to Tallahassee for further screening. And somehow I made it past the psychological, and then they job. But and I started the academy in 1990, and graduated. And they assigned me to Manatee County, and that's where I was from. So I was lucky to go back to my home county. A lot of my buddies didn't get to go back to where they were from. You know, they went to other counties. But I was able to get back here, and I worked for the Marine Patrol as an officer for about 4 years. Then I went undercover work, a thing called a resource protection unit, where we worked undercover stuff with regarding poaching, gill netting, smuggling. And then I was promoted in 97. And then we merged with the Florida Game Commission in 99. So just a series of events is how I became a game warden. It was kind of by accident. I didn't intend to become a game warden, but, you know, eventually merging with the Game Commission, you know, it was a really easy transition for me because I already worked with those guys. All the local game wardens here in the county, we all knew each other and we worked together on various things. So it was a real easy transition for me to go from saltwater to freshwater and hunting and, you know, catching gators and dealing with poachers and stuff. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. Just really opened up more horizons, you know, more things to do, as if there wasn't enough to do. Every day was different. That's what I really enjoyed about that career, was no 2 days were alike. And mm-hmm. You had no idea what was coming that day. It was just really exciting. So it was a good job, really good career.
So I have to ask, and I know it's going to be really difficult for you. Actually, I got two questions for you. One of these is for our Patreon listeners. Is Marion County as bad as the reputation that it has? Can you tell? Can you blink twice if it's a terrible county for we? So, bit of an inside joke there. About 2/3 of our listener, our Patreon group is from Marion County, and they always joke about how the poaching is really bad in Marion County, and they're all from that. It's them making fun of themselves. So I was just curious, and based on your demeanor, I'm thinking Marion County might be up there.
Well, I haven't worked as a game warden in the northern part of the state. All my time has been in Southwest Florida. You know, Polk County's got a pretty good reputation in that. Highlands County, you know, Manatee, all this area.
Yeah.
Poachers everywhere. No matter where you go, you're going to find them. They're out there doing it. And it always has amazed me that people will go to such lengths to do, you know, crazy stuff, you know, just to be able to keep something. That you take a deer and you skin it out and hang it up. I knew a guy, Eugene, used to have a store out east of town here, and he was a butcher. And he had people bring deer to him. Well, he also butchered goats for the local Mexicans. And you couldn't tell the difference between them hanging up when they're skinned. Mm. You had to really look hard.
Yeah.
But, I've seen people, try to, keep trout under their hat. I had a fellow one time, I was watching him. He was out wade fishing, and, he came back in and, asked him if he caught anything, and his hat started flopping.
What the hell?
He had a had a trout underneath his hat.
Oh, well, okay, so I don't know if that answers the second question I had for you, but what was, like, the most knuckleheaded thing you ever saw somebody, I mean, that's up there, but, like, what's the most knuckleheaded thing you ever encountered?
Well, this is Florida, so.
This is true, the bar is high.
Yeah, there's a lot. Now, I actually did not go on this call, but I met with an officer right after this had happened to him, and he related this story. He got his officer Rick Sloan. He's now retired. He lives out in Missouri. But Rick went on a call to Myakka State Park. And when he got out there, there were these two ladies that were, well, they were kind of tough ladies, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They were all scratched up. And so he had his, he was asking them what happened. He says, tell me what happened to you. And they said, well, we worship cats, you know, felines.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were out there in the woods, and they basically sprayed cat piss all over each other. And then they crawled around on all fours, you know, in the woods. I'm telling you, people, especially they get out in the woods, those things we've seen are amazing. And anyway, a local bobcat, he didn't take kindly to it. And so their god attacked them. This bobcat tore them up. I mean, they were scratched on it.
Oh, that's, you know, I feel like if you ever want to give a game warden a hard time, if he's ever grumpy or something, give him a pass, because that's the kind of stuff he's having to deal with, evidently. That's, oh, man.
We had another night. Jeff Babauta, he's also retired. And then we've got a guy who's now a lieutenant colonel up in Tallahassee, Brian Smith. They set up a road hunting detail one night with a robo deer. And they had it, you know, down at the end of a road where it teed into another road. And they were out in the palmettos. They had this thing set up. And, you know, it takes a lot of work to get one of those organized and set it up and, you know, get ready for it and waiting. And you're waiting for, you know, the right truck to come along. You know the truck. You got big old bogger tires on it and everything, you know. Oh, here's a good one. Here he's coming.
Yeah.
But this truck drives up. And it's just a little old, like a little small pickup. And they drove out in the palmettos near where they were at. And these two guys get out and they strip down and start chasing each other around naked. It's,
oh my God.
Both of these guys are known. They knew who they were. And these are the kind of guys that wouldn't want other people to know that they're doing this.
Yeah.
And
which is indicative of the fact they're doing this in the dark in the forest, you know.
They don't know anybody's out there. Finally, Jeff looks over at Brian. He says, have you had enough of this? He's like, yeah. Well, he took his pistol, I don't remember which one, and shot in the air. These two dudes left. They jumped in their truck, even without their clothes, and they were out of there. But it was messing up their detail, you know? It's like, we want to catch a fire hunter, not a couple of Fruit Loops.
Yeah. I can just see the anticipation. You know, they heard the hum of those mud tires, and they just knew what they were getting into until they just didn't.
Yeah.
I'm crying. That is too good. Oh my! Oh, I've told both these stories at least once or twice on the podcast. So I'll only tell one, but I know you'll get a kick out of this. I was turkey hunting spring of 2020 or 19, one of the two. And I'm out in the forest and I'm walking down this edge that goes right down a little creek edge, and it's like, I mean, we're good ways from a road, right? Like I'm doing the get away from everybody thing, and I'm walking through, and there's like these Peter pines to the left, and there's these like scraggly, really scraggly live oaks to my right. You can't climb these live oaks, kind of live oaks. You know what I'm talking about? And I'm walking down the road here. I'm like, what in the hell was that? And I'll admit it. Something does it in the twilight. You start to kind of wonder what it is. You know, it starts to weigh on you. Keep walking here. I'm like, where is that coming from? Like, what is this? And I start looking around and I hear, God dang it. Smack, thwack. And in a brown paper bag with poop hits the ground in front of me about 30 yards from me. And I look up and in the top of these live oaks that are stretched out, leaning, trying to find sunlight, are two hammocks tied at the top of the live oaks. I'm talking the very top of the canopy. And one dude's pissed that the other guy's snoring and waking him up. And so he's hurling the bags of fecal matter that I guess he's been packaging up there at the other guy's hammock. He gets pissed, starts throwing his fecal matter at the other guy. Neither of them are speaking English at all. And I'm just standing there with a shotgun on my shoulder, just staring up 50 feet while there's a poop fight between hammocks that I still can't figure out how they got up there. And then finally, one turns and looks at me and goes, huh, you know, and just like wide-eyed. And he points at me, and the other guy points at me, and I got out of there. I'm like, nope, I'm gone, dude. Like, I'm not playing this game. And so
holy smokes.
I tell that story on the podcast the year it happens. No one believes me. I don't blame them. 2 years later, we go to that same spot with a fellow who found me up because of the podcast. We turned into fast buddies. We now turkey hunt. And I'm telling him, I'm like, hey, this is that area that I told you about the podcast. And he elbows me really hard in the rib cage. And he's like, man, I love you, but you're a good storyteller. That's why I love the podcast, but you're a really good storyteller. We turn around the corner and there are two tattered hammocks that they never untied, still hanging from the trees. And I'm like, I told you, I effing told you. And like, I'm just screaming. The hunt is ruined. I was like, and he's just a jaw struck, just completely gone. And then when you went to the leaves, you could still see like the matted paper bags that were still on the forest floor. So when I saw that, I realized you guys had your work cut out for you, because there are just some weird people out there, dude.
Especially in the woods. That's why, you know, I don't ever, ever go to the woods without being armed.
Mm-hmm.
Working or not, there's a lot of crazy folks out there, and you never know what you're up to.
Yep, a lot of Florida fans, and they just scare the absolute crap out of me, man. It's yep. But all right, so let's get back. We got sidetracked, and I knew that was going to happen. I told you it was going to happen. Let's get back to it. Yep. You're working. I'm going to call it FWC, but I think you called it Maritime, right?
Yeah, it was Florida Marine Patrol starting, and then we merged in 99. It became the FWC. Yeah.
Gotcha. So you're doing this, and you're sitting there one day eating your breakfast, and the idea of a mud motor just popped into your mind. You invented it completely on your own.
Nope.
how did these two passions like intersect? I don't understand it. Help me with the connection.
Well, in after I'd been a Marine Patrol officer for about 4 years, I had a buddy that I went to college with. He's always telling me about Thai food. He's like, man, you need to try Thai food. It's amazing. You know, it's not like anything else. So one day I was driving my patrol car down Manatee Avenue in Bradenton, and I saw a sign that said Grand Opening Siam Cafe. And I like, that's Thai food. So I went home, got out of uniform, and I drove up there and went and ate. And my buddy was right. It was absolutely phenomenal food. Yep. And really hit it off with the waitress and with the owner of the place. And before I knew it was 11 o'clock at night. Me and the owner are sitting there drinking Budweiser, and the lights are out. And so I got hooked up, you know, running around, you know, eating at this restaurant a lot. And I just got to where I was hanging around with Thai people, and really liked them because they're wonderful folks. They're of all of Southeast Asia, the Thais have been our allies since the 1830s. They're very different than any of the other Asian countries around them. And they just have an amazing culture, amazing food. So anyway, Sam was the guy that owned this restaurant, and he eventually moved in with me. Cause I had a 3-bedroom house, and I was like, why are you paying rent, Sam? So I get where he was bringing food home to me.
Oh man.
And he would always tell me stories about back home, you know. And, you know, he had not been back to Thailand in many years. So I had said to him, I said, Sam, let's go. And so I started saving my money. I'd put money in a coat pocket in my closet until I had enough money to go. And then when I saved up enough, I said, Sam, let's go. He says, oh, I can't close the restaurant. He goes, I can't go. I said, sure you can. And but he wouldn't do it. So I went by myself. And while I was over there, I took a JanSport book bag, a towel, a shaving kit, a camera, and I took off across Thailand, and I absolutely loved it. You know, all across the country, I went up to the north in Chiang Mai, Chiang Rai, all the way around down to Isan and back to Bangkok, and then down to the southern part. But while I was there, I was staying in Chiang Mai, Thailand, up in the north in the mountains, in a little hotel, and there were some girls that were all college friends there that were there at the same time vacation, and they'd gone to college together, but they were working girls at this time. They worked in Bangkok at in the office buildings. So I met one of the girls there, and her and I started writing to each other when I got back to the States. And as it turned out, as fate would have it, she had an aunt right here in Bradenton, Florida. And so she came over and stayed with her aunt, and we started dating, and then she went back to Thailand, and then she came back again, and we got married. And so that's how I got hooked up with the Thais. And in my many trips to Thailand, I just became amazed about the Thai long tail. You know, I saw this thing, that this drivetrain was so simple, and yet it was so capable. And I was just always smitten with them. So those and this little Thai girl. So I ended up marrying her. And then every trip I'd go to Thailand, I'd spend as much time around Thai longtails and on the Klongs and at the races. I'd go to Thai longtail racing, which, by the That's way, awesome. Thai longtail racing, there's nothing like it. It is so spontaneous, so seat of the pants. These guys will all, they're just a bunch of country boys from the rice paddies. They'll get together, they'll text each other, and they'll say, hey, who wants to go to Rot Pai Rong Wua tomorrow, and we're going to race? They'll show up, and then all of a sudden, you got girls bringing vendors for selling food and stuff on the side of the canal. They call them Klongs. These guys don't wear any helmets. They don't have any kill switches, no safety equipment of any kind. And they run these little boats that are about the size and weight of your bathroom door, and they're made out of the same material. They're made out of luan, and they'll run these things at insane speeds. And it, to me, it's just the best racing there is.
What's an insane speed? 50 miles an hour?
Oh, no. We did a video back in 2012. It's on my YouTube channel, where we've got cameras in the boat, cameras out of the boat, 93 miles an hour.
Holy crap, dude.
But that's not the fastest. The fastest speed right now in Thailand is done by a Kawasaki with an SPS drivetrain, which SPS is the product I sell. And the current fastest speed is 119.
But most people can get at least 90 in their John boats, is what you're saying.
No, that's a highly specialized equipment. Yeah. But
boat, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, they're tiny. Yeah, I've got a couple of them. I have actually a couple of longtail boats of my own. But yeah, it's an amazing thing to see. It's not something easily seen, though. If you go to Thailand, you can't just go and see a longtail race because they don't really advertise it. You know, happens. You know, they, I guess they do have regular races at certain locations, but, you would have to know somebody because nothing's advertised in English, but, definitely a neat thing. So anyway, I got to delving more and more in Thai longtails, and I got to know the owner of, SPS, a guy named, Songsak Sripasert Ying. He started his business in 1957. He was the first builder of Thai longtails in Thailand.
Wow.
And matter of fact, the word longtail actually derives from Thailand. They call it Ruohong Yao, And Rua is boat. Hung Yao is tail long, boat tail long. So the very word long tail originated in Thailand, not here.
Cool.
Yeah. The first long tail here in the States was Warren Coco out in Louisiana. And he based what he said at one time on his website, he used to say that he based his design on long tail seen in Southeast Asia. I guess he might have been a vet. I don't know if he was a Vietnam vet or not, but that's what he used to say on his website. I don't know if it still says that, but what he saw was what we sell, pretty much unchanged. Not many changes at all. The neat thing about the Thai longtail, it's so simple, and yet it's so refined. There's been so many times over the years that I've tried to make changes to them. Got an egg on my face. You know, I'll be out at the test lake and I'll weld up something and go out there and try it. And I'm talking changing something, you know, an eighth of an inch or a pivot point, you know, just a little bit. And like, well, that didn't work. You know, it's I've developed more, you know, more and more respect for the guys that came before me. The more I mess with them, the more I see just how dialed in they really are. There's a lot to them, but when it comes to how they're set up and how they run, they don't run like the long tails that these, what I guess you would call American style. The American style ones use a U joint and they have a shorter shaft. Well, that U joint robs the engine of power, and then that shorter shaft creates a more steep shaft angle, so that your prop is closer to your boat. And anybody's run a boat any amount of time, you look back, you can see that where your boat is leaving a low pressure area, a trough behind the boat where it displaced the water. Mm-hmm. For time there, there's a lower area than all surface water around you as your boat goes forward. Right. And most of your long tails and all your surface drives, they run in that low water. So that propeller has to be down below that water, or at least right at the surface to get a bite. Where the Thai long tail, the reason our shafts are so long is we're taking advantage of that wake back there where that crest comes together behind your boat, you know, where the water comes back.
Mm-hmm.
The faster you go, the further back that crest is to a point. So you want to be in that crest. So with a Thai long tail, the actual propeller is running higher than the bottom of your boat, not lower. That's why, you know, when I run in rocky streams, like in Alaska and places where there's big boulders, I'm not worried about wiping out a prop. I'm more worried about knocking a hole in my boat, you know, in the bottom. They'll go places that, you know, an American style one would not go and, you know, in those regards. And they're faster too. You know, it's just a straight drivetrain. I had a friend of mine who's been a mechanic all his life, a guy named Bill. When I first started bringing these to the States, he came into the shop one day and I was sitting there in a chair, was around with some other guys, and we were just sitting around talking, and Bill came in and walked over to the bench, and he was looking at this long tail kit that we sell laid out on the bench, and I was just watching him. I didn't say anything, and Bill finally says, "My, how elegantly simple." And that's coming from a mechanic. And I thought that was the greatest compliment I've ever heard paid to the Thai longtail. "My, how elegantly simple." And I Bill, you're exactly right. It is. It's elegantly simple. There's not very many moving parts in it. It's just a very simple design. But anyway, Mr. Songsak, the guy who developed this in 57. Back then, people who were farmers were trying to get their crops to Bangkok, to the market. They had to paddle. Or the other alternative was they had little tugboats that had these little diesel motors in them that had a make and break gearbox. They would use those to get to market. And Songsak saw this because he used to work on those gearboxes, repairing them. And he saw a small general purpose engine you know, because Kohler started come to town. They were using these motors to pump water in the rice fields, and somebody came up with the idea to put one together and put a shaft on it. One of the very early ones had a bamboo shaft with a bamboo propeller. Of course, that, you know, didn't do a whole lot.
Yeah.
But you know, they tried all sorts of things, but it evolved, and Salksock saw these early attempts by other people, and he said, I can do better than that. So being the machinist that he was, he came up with the design you see today, and it's that design. I've got an antique long tail down in my shop from 1961 or 62, based on the motor that's hooked to it. It's an Elo. Based on that engine, we think it's about 1961 or 62 long tail. And it looks almost exactly like the long tail that we sell.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So you're talking about a design that hasn't changed in, what, 80 years?
No.
50 years, yes.
It doesn't really need to.
Yeah.
It works. And it works well.
So let's kind of, so we're going to come back to the Alaskan thing, because I think that's like the epitome of a testimony. And I think it's also just a badass story. I was floored when I saw you making posts about it up there, because it just, it's something that I associate with Florida, not that area. Yeah. So you talked about how some of these American designs are different, and the simpleness of the system. I remember when I found your YouTube channel back when we first, you know, got in contact, and I was pestering you with a bunch of questions. I remember watching a young girl putting this thing together on the YouTube channel. And to me, I was immediately skeptical, because I was like, there's no way, right? Like, that just seems like the ultimate gimmick, right? You train this little girl to do it, countless hours of preparation, and you watch the video and it's stupid simple.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, how efficient is this as a tool? We talked about these small boats and how fast they can get. How efficient is this in weeded, choked out areas with a John boat? Like, is this a heavy workhorse? Is this a niche item? Kind of give me some feedback there.
Well, when I first started bringing the long tail to the States, we had our issues with weeds and vegetation, because we did not have our skeg was more like a racing skeg than a weedless skeg. So I had to come up with a skeg that was more weedless for it. And the very first ones we sold, we didn't have weedless props either. So, so that, but, I came up with, a really good weedless prop that we worked on, and it a lot of work into that thing. And it's an excellent little prop. That took care of that problem. And, I came up with also a weed cutter that you can attach to our skeg, and it will, as vegetation does try to get wrapped around the prop, because a weedless prop, what it is, it's got negative rake to it. It helps for to slough the weeds off, but
what's negative rake? Help me out with that. I've never heard that before.
Well, it will, when a prop is designed the way they the shape, it's kind of hard to explain, but the way the shape of the prop is, the way the blade curves around, the weed can slide off of it easier.
Okay.
Than something with positive rake. So the prop is called weedless. It's not weed free. So you still can get some weeds a little bit,
All,
but there's a trick. There's a couple things you can do. We put this little piece of bar metal on our skeg that sticks out right just shy of the prop blade. And when it does try to get a piece of vegetation around it, it comes around and that bar actually cuts it. Yeah. You've seen cutters on weed eaters too, like this, or trolling motors.
Yep.
Matter of fact, I think a trolling motor is where I got the idea. So anyway, we came up with that, which also helps. There's another thing you can do when you're out running them. Mm-hmm. When you're on a plane running a long tail, you can take your hand and just dip down real quick and just clear the prop out of the water for a split second. As you're running, you don't even come off plane. It's so quick. when you're running through really thick vegetation, you do that every now and then and just dip the prop real quick, and it'll sling anything off. So that's some of the things that we've employed to be able to push these things through real thick vegetation, you know, where you're throwing the stuff off. Because some vegetation is fibrous.
Yes.
And that's the stuff mm-hmm. that gets the stuff that's like cellulose that just flies apart, you know, like hydrilla, that's no problem. It just cuts it up, or water lettuce, all that. But you start getting into some of that grass, and some of that can be it can be a nightmare. But by employing all those things, you can get through it a lot easier and with a lot less problems.
Does having that prop higher than the bottom of the boat also kind of help with that? Because you're not pushing the prop further down into the water column, thus grabbing more.
I think it does, you know, because yeah. it's out the rest of the wake. So you're getting more water than stuff off the bottom. You're not dredging stuff up. So yeah, I think it does.
I'm sure that negative rake has a bit of a performance trade-off as well.
Actually, the little prop that we have, our little 6.5 inch prop, and then we've got an 8 3/4 version of it. Those actually, our 6.5 especially, does 1 mile an hour faster than my little standard prop. I was really pleased with how that little prop turned out. You know, I made a lot of versions of it until I got out there and I had one that was like, whoa, we have a winner, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah.
Is this something that in the design process you were working real closely with the ties to bring something over here? Because it doesn't sound like they deal with a lot of weeds from what you're talking about.
The ties use a long tail very differently than we do. We use a long tail for recreation and for on our days off. The ties use it for transportation. I've got friends in Thailand who live in stilt houses out in the country or on a klong, and that's the only way to their house. That is wow. that is their Ford. If you say to them, hey, let's go over out there in them weeds, they would be like, why? so their use over there are much different than here.
Yeah. Did you ever try and explain that to them and just see a look of confusion?
Yeah. I've like, you know, when I show them videos too of what we do over here, you know, I think they're starting to kind of get it. They're like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. But
because with them, they also have limited resources over there. There's, you know, there's a struggle for, to be able to compete for resources, you know, where you're going out, you know, trying to gather this or fish for that. And being able to get somewhere, that other people can't go, you know, has its advantages to be able to do that. So
what I hear you saying is Swamp Runner Tie is coming. You're going to have a whole division over there back of your weedless props so that people can get to places they need to. I see the long con. You take their technology, you bring it here, you adapt it, you take it back, you give back to the community. I see where you're going with it, man.
Yeah. There are some things being used in Thailand that I have developed. I developed a bushing system, and that's probably the best thing that I've ever contributed to a Thai longtail. And I had a lot of failures trying to come up with it. But the Thai longtail itself uses a wooden bushing internally inside the ship. Nothing wrong with that bushing. It's an excellent bushing. Been using it since 1957. They tend to wear a little faster than other materials. But we do have shafts out there with wood bushings in them that, you know, people running 10 years old. They're wow. great. That shaft I have down at the shop that's from 1961, 62 still has the original wood bushings in it. The wood they use over there is a redwood, and it doesn't swell in water.
Mm.
It's an excellent wood for maritime use. I had a phone call one time from a guy who was asking me a lot of strange questions, a lot of odd questions, and I kind of got the feeling he wasn't a customer, that he was a competitor. And I thought, you know, I want to test this. So the guy was asking me what the wood material is in our shafts. And I said, oh, it's made of Tukian wood. And so he said, okay, how do you spell that? And I told him, and I'll be darned if it wasn't, you know, just a short while later, those words showed up on his website. And that's not what it's made from. The wood in Thailand, the wood Tukian is actually, the Thais are very superstitious people, and they believe that the Tukian trees, there's actually fairies that live in them. And you can go to the fairy to get lottery numbers or whatever. They'll even hang clothing in the trees for the fairies. They'll put powder on the trees. It's the darndest thing you ever saw. But the Thais would never, ever use a Tukian tree for their shafts. The only thing those trees are used for are for dugout canoes for racing, ceremonial racing.
Yeah.
And they use them for their funeral pyre. For a funeral, and that's it. There's no other use for that tree.
They dang sure wouldn't make a bushing out of it.
No. So when I tell the Thais that, they laugh. They think that's the funniest part. But yeah.
How do you spell that wood?
Ian. T-A-K-I-E-N.
Anyway. I'm gonna have to cut that out of this podcast because my listener base will absolutely go searching to figure out who that was, and I don't want them to do that.
He's off there now. I don't think anymore. But anyway, back to the bushing. This bushing I come up with, it's made of polymer, and I won't say what's in it. I went to a patent attorney I was going to patent it, and the guy said, son, you don't want to patent this. And I said, why not? He goes, because you would have to reveal your formula, and all your competitors would have to do is change it just a tiny percent, mm-hmm. and they've beaten your patent. He said, just keep your mouth shut. So that's what I've done all these years. There's only myself and my wife knows, and no one that works for me knows what's in it. The people who make it for me, they don't know what it's for. And they ship it to some folks for me, and it gets moved to another. So there's a lot going on to keep it from the people at our factory don't even know where it comes from. But it's an amazing bushing. We put it in a test tank out behind the shop, and we ran it for over a month nonstop at 3,600 RPMs. In a tank full of mud and sand and grit and debris. And I'd go out once a week and I would stop, turn off the motor. It's an electric motor running at 3,600 RPM to simulate a small mm-hmm. engine throttle. And I'd turn it off once a week, go check the end of the tail bushing to see if there was any play in it. No play. And so after 1,018 hours, I finally said, Steve, we're just burning electricity. And we shut it off. And still there was play in it, you know, but you had to use a micrometer to measure it. There was no discernible play by the naked eye or the hand in that tail shaft. So that's the stuff I used when we did the Yukon descent. Again, you know, no play in it. Matter of fact, that shaft's still in Alaska being used by a friend up there that hunts with it all the time. And, but that is the most durable drivetrain component that I know of in any mud motor anywhere. There is no mud motor anywhere that can beat that. You know, most of the other companies run bearings. When your seals give way and, you know, water intrudes, you know, your bearings are going to be trash. And they can be expensive. And, you know, frustrating, but, ours doesn't have any bearings except for up in the coupler itself. We've got a bearing up there way up near the motor, but down near the prop where the water is and all, there's no bearing down there. It's just these bushings, and they don't care. They just keep going.
Okay. So what's the maintenance like on this elegantly simple design? Like what if you use it on the weekends and whatnot,
you know, not like you where you're out there running it, you know, mm-hmm. for the testing, but for the weekend warrior, which is the person listening to this podcast, what kind of annual maintenance are we looking at?
Actually, somebody who runs it, you know, weekend or every now and then, it would be more important to do maintenance than somebody that uses them every day, you know, that runs. The ties don't really do anything to them because they, except for the racers. The racers will take their shafts out when they get home, and they'll hang them up or sit them in a bucket, and they'll pour used motor oil down the shaft and let that run all the way through and coat the bushings inside. So it basically coats the shaft with oil to displace the water so that the shaft doesn't rust. And we tell people the same thing here. Just, you know, take your shaft out of the coupler. You just loosen the two wing bolts, pull the shaft out, stand it in a bucket. If you run it in salt water, run water down the end of the shaft and just flush it out, you know, and let it flush real good. And then stand it in a bucket, pour some oil in it. Doesn't matter what kind of oil. We don't care. It can be cooking oil, use motor oil, anything. And just something to coat the shaft inside, and just leave it standing in that bucket till the next time you're going to use it. Other than that, there really is no other maintenance.
That's okay. It's a lot easier than my outboard. In fact, I just I had to network. My wife bought me this canoe for Father's Day 2020.
Mm-hmm.
2021. And it's a 1987 canoe. And she got me a 1984 Evinrude 9.9 with a 15 horsepower 15 horsepower carb and needle kit and everything. It's upgraded. Yeah. It has ran efficiently for about 3 months.
Uh-huh.
And I finally just ran out of time. And a Patreon member whose father works on outboard said, listen, Dad said, you know, he feels sorry for you. You should be able to figure this out. But since you can't, just send it to me. You know, let's meet up. My dad will work on it and get it going. It took all of that to get that outboard going. We're talking about a lawnmower and pouring oil down the shaft. And I like the simplicity of that because I've got my own business. I got a podcast. I got a wife, a kid, a full-time job, but I can find time to do that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the one thing that, being a, fish and wildlife lieutenant taught me over the years of, I had to handle all the bills for repairs for everyone on my squad. And, you know, twin engine patrol boats, there aren't cheap to operate or keep running. You know, these days they have to use a laptop to diagnose what's wrong on them. And, you know, parts are crazy expensive, and saltwater, or just any marine mechanic is crazy expensive. You know, they charge pretty healthy rate. So, the idea of having a general purpose engine that has no electronics on it, you know, there's no onboard computer, you can work on it yourself. Parts are readily available. It's air cooled, so you don't have to worry about an impeller being chewed up by sand. You know, all of those things are a win-win for, you know, the working guy who doesn't have time for all that or the extra cash either.
Well, and, you know, add another layer to this. If in this area, if you don't run Yamaha, Mercury, or a 2000 and new and 2000 and a 2000 and newer Honda, there's no one to work on outboards. There's no one here. There's no one who will work on it. So God forbid you're a working class fella who has been given a motor, who has maintained a motor over the years, and they're freaking expensive now. They are stupid expensive. My dad and I ordered in 2015 a Nissan 15 horse marine grade four stroke, $1,300. And that was paying for all the saltwater grade components and doing the whole dude, you can barely find a used outboard for $1,300. That's in any kind of good condition.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. You know, when I first started as a young officer in the early 90s, you'd go out on Tampa Bay to Egmont Key or out along the Causeway in Palmasola, and the boats would be stacked up one next to another. I mean, right up on the beach, just pulled up one next to another. And they had massive parties. It just, there was lots of people on the water. And that all changed though, as boating became more and more expensive. that started dwindling to where, you know, you go out there and you just see a handful, just, you know, a few boats on the weekend. It was just crazy that the transition from when I started as a young officer to near where I retired, how boating had become so cost prohibitive that there was a lot fewer people that could afford it. I get it out. But, yeah, really changed a lot.
So let's talk about some of the things that pertain, like questions, the common thoughts that I've had, things that people have passed along to me. I know these are all questions that you probably hear on a routine basis, but, I have often found if one person has a question, there are normally thousands who have the same question. And then I want to wrap up, I think, with your Alaskan voyage, because I'm looking at these photos and it hurts my heart. It's beautiful. I want to be there on a boat and not, you know what I'm saying? Like it calls to you. So one of the obvious limitations to this motor is you don't have reverse. How do you cope with that?
Well, it's a simple design, you know, not having a reverse just makes you one less thing to break, you know, with clutches and all that. So when you're approaching a dock or a boat ramp, you tilt your prop out of the water, but you're no longer have that thrust to propel you forward. So that causes the boat to slow down. So you just, you'll just ease up. You slow up when you're approaching another boat, you know, you're going to come alongside or a dock or the beach or whatever. You just slow down as you're coming up to it. And the nice thing about a tie longtail or longtail in general is you can lift the prop out of the water and you can move it over, you know, 20 degrees and put it back in the water to change the direction. Mm. And another thing you can do in that regard is if you're stuck out there in some mud, you can reach over to this water with it or over to that water over on the other side of the boat with it, where you can't do that with an outboarder service drive. So with a long tail, the propeller has a lot more options when it comes to water around the boat to reach to. It also is very handy when you're climbing over logs. You know, if you're climbing over a log that's right on the surface of the water, you'll the long tail is back there behind way behind the log, and it's able to push the boat over that log. And then when you reach the log, you just tilt up and, you know, keep your prop above the log till you float free of the log, and then put your prop back down in the water. A surface drive, you can't do that. You'll get hung up on the log most likely with a surface drive. But so it does have its advantages like that, you know. The surface drives, though, are easier to drive. There's no doubt about that. You got a two-dimensional driving. You side to side, you're like an outboard, whereas a long tail is three-dimensional where you're holding the tiller handle. But once you get on a plane with a long tail and it's dialed in, it'll find its spot and it'll want to stay there, and you just don't really want to fight it. You just let it ride where it wants to ride.
Okay, so you created a beautiful segue to my next question, which is, I've got several friends with mud motors. They all started with a variation of a long tail. About half of them are still with long tails. The other half said they could never get it to not fight them and find that sweet spot. What are they – this is a very visual question, but what are they doing wrong?
Well, there's so many variables. There's a section in the back of our owner's manual that's a series of questions. And I want to say it's like about 15 questions. It's things, you know, if it's doing this, do this first, and then do this second, and then do this third. And you go through that series of troubleshooting questions, and you can dial your motor in. One of the questions would be, not from that manual, but one of the questions I would ask is, what brand is it? What motor is it? Because there are others out there that you can fight them, and you're going to continue fighting them because the balance is not right on them. They're just not built right. They're not set up right. But with ours, there are things just in general with a long tail. If it does have the right geometry, you can actually tweak it. You can put a little bend in your skeg to port. If you're standing behind the skeg, you would bend it to port with like a crescent wrench, just slightly. And that will take away prop torque because your prop is walking to the left. Okay. And when you have it on the end of a very long shaft, that becomes more pronounced. So your prop, as it turns, is walking in the water to the left. Well, that skeg being bent creates just enough water flow over that bent skeg to push it back to center. So that bend is so slight, but it will cause your prop to run right in the center of that wake that we were talking about earlier. If you're not in the center of that wake, you're going to fight it. If it wants to come out of one side of that wake or the other side of the wake, that's because it's not running dead center, and it just needs a little tweak, probably on the skeg.
Say that again.
If it's our long tail, if it's a swamp runner, chances are all you're going to need is a little tweak on the skeg to make it run straight right in the middle there.
What about the people who I've talked to people who've said that long tails, typically speaking, you have to fight it to keep it in the water. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's because those long tails weren't in that crest where that wake comes back together, and that's one of those reasons. Am I onto something?
There's many reasons why they could be fighting it. One of the most common reasons is overpropping. Like a guy wants to run a 9-inch prop on a 13, 14 horse motor that should be running an 8.5. They're wanting to overprop. So that will be, you'll fight that. There's no doubt. You go down a prop size. That's in those questions in our back of our book. That's what in the manual, it'll talk about that. I think that's the very first one, but overpropping can do that. What else? Outrunning the wake can do that, and that has to do with shaft length. We have we offer more shaft lengths than any other mud motor company. If you got a wider boat, if the bottom of your boat is I'd say 40 inches or more, we really don't recommend anything over about 45-inch wide boat. 48, somewhere in there, but the narrower the better with a long tail. And I'm talking the bottom of your boat, not the gunnels, but down on the bottom, the narrower the better. And a narrow hull, that wake is going to be not as far back. With a hull, that wake can be further back. And also, if you increase speed, that wake can be further back. So it's important with a tie long tail to be in the crest of that wake when you're running.
I could see that, and I think that's one of the reasons we talked about the Gnu was actually a pretty suitable option. That the swamp runner was a really good suitable option for the Gnu.
Yeah, it is. That's a really good combination there. We've got guys running like little 6.5 horse, Harbor Freight or Honda motor on those, and they'll push them real well.
Yeah, it's surprising when you go to YouTube. There's not a lot of people that have that combination on YouTube, and it's surprising to me, especially in Florida, because of the two things are hand in hand. If you think Gnu, you think Florida, and if you think mud motor, you're probably thinking Florida, Georgia, South Carolina kind of thing. But man, the people who have it, you got people like out on big water lakes who have these mud motors, and they have a blast because they're able to get these Gnus up into creeks and channels that people can't get to just for bass fishing. And they just, they love it. So I feel like the only, when I'm hearing you talk, the limitation is the size of the boat with these. So I think that what we probably have a possibility of is, probably some of these people who have a negative connotation may have the wrong setup for the boat, right? It sounds like that's part of it. It sounds like they are maybe not giving Mr. Dobbs a call to that specs for everything.
That happens. If people call us, generally Steve at the shop answered the phone, and Steve can talk anybody through, he'll ask a series of questions, and he can usually get them straightened out. Boat width is important. The type of boat's important. A flat bottom is better than a V hull. And a narrow hull is better, but there are those reasons. And if someone's putting one on a boat that's got a really high transom too, that can also have a negative impact. So generally, you know, a standard transom, 15, 16 inch transom is what we tell people. But we've had people call us up wanting to put them on airboat hulls or something super wide. And we just tell them, sorry, buddy, you can't do that. Generally, when somebody has a wide hull and they call our shop, what we tell them is go buy a service drive. I'm not in the business of, just trying to sell something. We want people to be happy, and we know they're not going to be happy if they put a long tail on a hull that's, 48 inches wide. Chances are they're not going to be happy with that.
So let's talk about the Yukon trip, man.
Mm-hmm.
The Yukon is a beast. We are talking about, you said it best. The Alaska is the last frontier. It's the place where men go and find out just how manly they are. Everybody I know that's gone to Alaska comes back different. My little brother, my sister was stationed in Alaska, and my little brother took every opportunity to go up there and see her. And he's like, dude, we've got to do a float trip. Like, before your knees get bad, before your back gets bad. He's significantly younger than me, so it's a legit concern for him. He's 22 and I'm 33. So 21, he's 21. He just turned 21. And so he's like, before your knees get bad, like we got to do it. And then you got to prepare, 'cause you got to take your kid. And so like, you got to figure it out. Here I am, 80 degrees, a couple years back, 80 degrees, scrolling through Instagram. And I see this crystal clear water with icebergs and woolly mammoths walking down the bank, and here comes a mud motor down the bank. What the heck were y'all doing?
Oh, wow. I went to Alaska. My very first trip to Alaska was on a cruise ship, probably like most people would go up there. Very typical. And we did the inside portion of a cruise too, from Fairbanks down through Denali and down to Anchorage, and then got on the boat and came down the Inside Passage. And the whole time I was like, I just kept saying to myself, I got to be out there. I got to be out there. You know, I would look out a train window and just, or a bus window and say, I want to go out there. I want to see that. And we went on a trip called the White Pass Railway. It went from Skagway up where the old Chilkoot Trail, where the miners crossed over into Canada, into the Yukon. We took that train up and went over into Canada, and I got to see the headwaters of the Yukon. It was some lakes up there, a lake called Tagish. And when I saw that lake, the idea just hit my head. I said, I have to float that. I have to run that river. And, it just gnawed at me for the next several years. And I started planning it. And there was a lot to think about because of logistics with fuel, with weight of, your cargo, what safety equipment do you bring? How many people do you bring? There's issues with, there's certain things you have to have duplicates of up there. You don't just go with one. So I had to figure out all of that, the weight, fuel sources, where do you fuel, how much fuel are we going to carry, how much fuel consumption, all those things. So it's after 4 years of this, it finally started coming together, and a lot of testing on the lake with cargo in the boat. We go to our local lake here, run it. And I talking with Briggs and Stratton about their consumption on their motors, that, which one has the right fuel consumption and the right ability for carrying the payload we needed. And then there was the boat. The boat was a really big deal. And that came together, out of Southeast Asia. I had some guys in Southeast Asia build me two boats, and we shipped them here, brought them to Florida, And the reason I wanted these boats is because they had a narrow bottom and very long. And if you read any of the old books on the days of the Garwood racing hulls back in the 1930s, where they were, these rich men raced these mahogany race boats, what they figured out was hull speed increased when you increase the length of a boat. That's just a, that's one of the rules of marine architecture that, and they figured this out. So they would lengthen the hull of the boat, and they would also have to add a little more horsepower to that, and their hull speed would go up. And that's how these guys kept beating each other in racing. Well, they also figured out that a long, narrow hull back in those days, if you looked at pictures, old pictures of these launches and these old river boats and stuff that transported people and cargo, they were narrow and long because they didn't have a lot of horsepower to deal with to push those. We're talking displacement hulls now. In this situation, they didn't have a lot of the horsepower to push their cargo with. So the most ideal hull to push a heavy payload with a very small engine is something that's long and narrow.
Makes sense.
So these boats that we use, they were 21 foot 6 inches long, and they're about 40 inches wide gunnel to gunnel. The bottom on them, I think, is about 35 inches on the bottom. And they were made of fiberglass. I wanted fiberglass because I can repair that out in the middle of nowhere, and which we did. We did end up having to repair. So that all came together, and that my mechanic ended up being a guy from Nebraska, a guy named Troy Anzalone. Excellent mechanic, excellent machinist, and an outdoorsman, and he used our product. That's how I got to know him, is he was using Swamp Runners, and just crazy about him. He runs the rivers out there. He did a trip from Elkhorn, Nebraska to St. Louis, Missouri, which was about 700 miles. And he took like a Rokon motorcycle in the boat with him. I don't know if you know what those are.
I do. I had one, yeah. Actually. Yeah.
I've got one.
I love them.
Yeah. But anyway, he would use that Rokon to go get fuel at these little towns as he's coming through, you know, Nebraska and Missouri. And so he made that run. And that's what convinced me to invite him along on this trip. I'm like, Troy, you want to do something more fun than that? And he's like, he knew I was going to be making this trip. There was a few people who knew about it. And he said, John, he goes, I've been so hoping you were going to ask me to go.
That's awesome.
So he ended up, I flew him up and my videographer, a young guy out of Orlando, I flew them into Whitehorse. And I rigged these boats up and all our gear and my little GMC pickup. And I stacked the boats on a trailer and we hauled them up. I drove all the way up there. It took about 14 days.
Yeah.
From Florida to Whitehorse. And I picked them up at the airport. And then we had another buddy of mine. He's actually Yupik Eskimo. Mm-hmm. He lives in Fairbanks. He flew in to Whitehorse. So the four of us, we go down to we go south, which is basically going uphill, and we go into British Columbia to a little place. Man, I'm trying to think of the name of the lake. Most beautiful place I've ever seen in North America. Absolutely gorgeous. What is the name of that little town? It's near the Llewellyn Glacier. Anyway, I don't know why I can't think of that tonight, but anyway, we launched there, and there was a local guy there who knew the waters real well. So we asked him about the local waters. There's a little river goes from this lake down to a lower lake, and asked him about that. And he says, oh, he goes, you'll be able to do it. No problem. He goes, the water's good. He goes, you can do it. He goes, I'll show you. He goes, there's some bends in it though. You got to watch because, most rivers, the inside of the bend is, or the outside is the deep water and the inside is not. He goes, well, with this river, he goes, for some reason, he goes, there's a couple spots. It's the opposite. But anyway, he was quite the sourdough, quite a neat old guy. And I just found out that he's passed away since. Mm-hmm. But so we ended up launching on this lake, and the buddy from Fairbanks takes my truck and trailer and starts driving back to Alaska. And no sooner did he leave, this old sourdough says to me and my two guys, he goes, you know that river is class four rapids, right? And I'm like, I said, why did you just now tell me this? I said, in front of my crew, I said, you never said this before. You said we could make it just fine. He goes, well, I thought if I told you that you wouldn't go if you still had your truck and trailer.
Oh my God.
So anyway, we ended up hiking up to the glacier. We had to go up the lake about 40 miles. And then we had to hike up to this glacier about 12 miles. And so we start at the glacier, hike back down, get in our boats and start coming down river and, or down the lake. And then, we get back where this, river is. We shoot the river, and, I ended up both boats. We punched holes in the bottom of them, coming through those rapids. And, when we got down to the bottom, there was an old railroad depot down there left over from the late 1800s. They had a boxcar sitting there and tools and stuff, and the place was empty. And so we slept inside this old
that's cool
wharf. It was really cool. And we fished for grayling right there while we had the boats flipped over, fixing the bottoms on them and everything, and had a great time there fishing and working on the boats. And then we left there and the following day and went on down the lake, and we went to some old mining camps down there that were just absolutely phenomenal places, just absolutely beautiful. There's a place called Ben Micree. If you looked it up, it was a Welshman and his wife came there in the 1880s, and they built this place, and it looks like Switzerland. It's still there. It's very remote. When you pull up on the beach, there's nothing but wolf tracks and bear tracks. But you go up to the house, you can open the door, walk in. There are newspapers from the 1800s. There's beds. There's furniture. Everything's there.
How did they get it there?
Well, by steamship back then.
Yeah.
But that was back when the Yukon actually had a lot more people on it in the 1800s than it does today.
Okay. Farming.
Yeah. All that's gone now. So, but this place, Ben Micree, is just it's just something from the past. It's absolutely, it's spelled B-E-N, my, and Cree, I think, C-H-R-E-E, Ben Micree. Absolutely beautiful place. But I'd say it's the prettiest place I've ever been in North America. So we continued our journey down river, and we'd sleep under the stars each night. And I did most of the cooking. And we ate pretty good. The meal preparation took a lot longer than I expected it to be. So the other guys got to fish a lot more than I did. But we had a great time. One of the things we tried to do is to, we sent a drone up in just about every town or village that was on that river. So we have drone footage of it. We haven't edited it yet, but I don't know that anyone's ever done that before, but you could actually see the towns and little villages from the air. So that's kind of a neat thing that we've done. And it was an amazing trip. We got the weather was about as good as it could be for Alaska. You know, it was August, July, August. We got some rain. We got to an area called the Yukon Flats. The river braids, that's in Alaska.
Right.
And it braids unbelievably to where the rivers can be 20 miles wide in, you know, braided section.
Yeah.
All that.
Yeah.
And you just keep going down and you don't know where the channel is because it braids so much. But just prior to hitting the Yukon Flats, we'd stopped in a little village, a circle, And I knew a trapper there, and his wife is the second chief of the village. So they came down to the river to greet us and visit with us for a while. And we're standing there in the rain, and typical Alaskans, they're wearing like hoodies, just cotton hoodies pulled, and it's raining on them. And I said, you guys don't have to stand out here. And he's like, oh no, we don't have nothing better to do. But his wife, as we're saying goodbye, she goes, oh, by the way, there's a weather report that there's going to be 80-mile-an-hour winds. And she just says it as like an aside, like as an afterthought. I'm like, oh, well, thanks for telling me. So we ran into that in the middle of the Yukon Flats. So it was like the worst place to hit that. But we ended up just sheltering on an island till it passed. But that storm put so much flotsam and debris into the water that for almost the next 1,000 miles, we're trying to outrun that log jam. You know, we would outrun it. We'd put up camp, and the next morning there it would be again. So we had a lot of debris in the water, a lot of logs and stuff. So we'd hit submerged stuff quite a bit. And it was really neat, that river, because there's so many little villages that you come to, and you'll meet someone, and then you'll go down river further, and somebody that's 600 miles down river will ask about somebody you met and ask how they are.
That's crazy.
It's a world up there, as far as the people, they know each other. Alaskans are really a unique breed. They're really neat folks.
Yeah.
Very unpretentious. You know, what you see is what you get.
I found your photos actually from your trip when I Googled Ben McCree. Your photos were the stuff that actually popped up, and you're right. It looks like little Switzerland. It's gorgeous. I see this cabin, man. It's crazy to think that thing's been sitting there for as long as it has. Like, you'd think it'd be gone.
Yeah. You know, it's so remote, you know, that, people don't bother anything there. Anybody that have the means to get there is not going to bother anything, so it stays fairly untouched, you know. And the people have the people that own it now, they're actually the family of a man who, he was a cabin boy on a steamship, and he came there as a kid. Uh-huh. And the very first time he saw Ben McCree, he says, I want to own that one day. And the opportunity came later in life, and he was able to actually buy it, and it's still in the same family.
That's cool.
Yeah, but they just got a sign on the door that says, you know, leave things as you found them. And that's it. But yeah, there's some great folks up there. There's little cabins along the river, places where they don't lock them. They'll leave a supply of firewood, you know, in case, you know, if it's wintertime, somebody comes in and they're freezing, life-threatening conditions. Yeah. You got to have to build a fire. And there's usually always, in any cabin you go into, there's firing matches right there. And, you know, you just stock it back up yourself and leave it how you found it. But Alaska is a neat place. It really is.
Oh, man. That just sounds like a good time, dude. Like, there's no part of that is a maybe the 80 mile an hour winds, maybe, but it's Florida. We deal with that during hurricane season.
Yeah.
I can figure out a way. How did the boats and the motors handle that log jam?
You know, I hit many, many times. It was so frustrating. And my prop was wearing down, my aluminum prop I was running over, because I don't run stainless props on my long tails. When I'm in a remote country, I run aluminum props. And I just want to be able to, you can always put another aluminum prop on. You can't, you know, replacing a shaft is a lot harder.
Right.
So I run aluminum props when I hunt up there or wherever I go. But I ran the same prop from the glacier down to, trying to think of the name of the little town there. There's an Air Force base there. Basically 1600 miles. I put on one prop before I needed to change it. And it had some dings and it was starting to get bent, and it was starting to get some vibration in it. you know, I was wanting to do the whole river on one prop, but it just didn't happen. So I ended up having to change out, and I did the rest of the river with a different prop. But I've got that prop laying on my desk in there, the one that, you know, I ran 1,600 miles with. So they did surprisingly well. They did well. You ask about how the boats did. They, you know, they're a very narrow hull and long. We came to an area down where we start, as you came down river, the river would become wider and wider. And every village we would come to, the local people would say two things to us. They would say, you know, the river's going to get wider, don't you? And the next thing they would say is, look out for those Indians down river. They're mean. At the next village, they always said that, every one of them, but pretty comical folks. But anyway, we they weren't lying. When we get down further down river, yeah, as you start to get near the mouth of the river is 5 miles wide. 5 miles.
Wow. Wide. That's
and
huge.
The Mississippi's nothing in comparison. There were islands that were 50 miles long in the river. It was just phenomenal. We were running along anyway, and this one, I had to have a resupply done about halfway down river. There's a road going out of Fairbanks. They call it the Hall Road. It's the road up to Prudhoe Bay. It's the one you've heard of, ice boat trackers, those guys use. It goes over the Brooks Range. It's super remote country. And I needed a resupply there. And so I flew a buddy up from Florida. Actually, it was two game wardens. They were guys I worked with, the guys I trusted, Rob Gerken and Grant Burton. They came up and they flew into Fairbanks and they got my truck from my friend there. He had to work, so he wasn't available to come up and do the resupply. So they drove up and resupplied us up there. And that's the only bridge in all of Alaska that's the only bridge that crosses the Yukon is there.
Huh.
So after our resupply, we came on down river, and you know, we're still playing tag with this log jam that we keep seeing. Saw a lot of wildlife along the way as well. You know, moose, bears, everything. We get down to a place called near a place called St. Mary's, and there's oxbows that come off the river. The river's so wide, it's just huge. And I look back and I see an aluminum fishing skiff coming up on us, and I didn't know what these guys were doing, what they were about. And one thing up there is it's a pretty lawless place. Uh-huh. There's no law out in the bush. So I pulled my 12 gauge shotgun out of the case and had it ready as they're approaching us. And as they come up next to me, they come off plane, and I'm thinking, oh, I hope this is good. And it was two local guys. And one of the guys said in broken English, he says, "You follow me." He says, "I know a shortcut." So I just nodded and thanked him, and he took off, and I fell in behind him, and he took us into this oxbow, which was much narrower. And it cut about probably 20 miles off of our trip.
Holy cow.
But not only that, the wind was out of the northwest. So when you came around that bend, it started hooking to the northwest. If we had been in that main channel, it was really nasty. So when we did come out into the main river again, he was long gone. He was already gone. He was in a much larger boat. But we got to the main river. I remember Troy being in the boat next to me, and we're looking ahead, and he says, "What is that?" And we're looking out onto this sea. It's not a river, it's a sea. And all I could see was this line of red. And then on top of it, a thin line of white. And then you could see the sky, you know, blue sky. And I said, "Troy, that's waves." That's red clay waves. And it was easily 6 foot seas.
Holy wow.
And I've worked out on saltwater, you know, a good bit of my life. I've done a lot of time offshore, and that's the most scared I've ever been in a boat. We were, I told Troy, I said, point the bow into these waves as we go into this. I says, we're going to commit to it. And once you go, do not get sideways. If you don't keep the bow into the waves, you will roll. And if you roll, you cannot recover you. And so we kept the boats into the waves and fought it, you know, and you just kept getting water up, you know, over the sides and on you. And we eventually made it to St. Mary's. And then when we were on that north shore, it was on the lee side of the wind. So we were able to skirt the north shore, and it was much better water up there. But that was probably the some of the worst water we've been through, except for the rapids up in the, you know, up in the Canadian Rockies. So went through that and came on down river, and we came to a little village called Mountain Village. And I happened to know a guy there who was a missionary preacher there. And he actually owned one of my mud motors from back in his days in Iowa. He's a big duck hunter. So got to stop in and visit with him and spend some time there. It was good to catch up with him, and great time. But we were coming down an area, remote area, one evening, and I couldn't find a place to camp. And because there's not a lot of campsites, you know, the mountains are straight up and down, and there's, you know, a lot of thick vegetation and underbrush. So not a lot of options when it comes to camping up there, but coming down the river. And it was getting close to dark, and, you know, it was cold and spitting a little rain. And I said a little prayer. I said, Lord, find me a campsite. And there was an island that we'd been running by. And then there was a break in an island before the next island. And these islands are long. So I looked between these two islands and I saw some cottonwood trees. And I thought, that looks like a flat spot over there. So I turned the boat and started heading over to behind these islands. And as soon as I did, I looked to my left and there were three crosses on a hill right there. So I looked over to my left, and this is the middle of nowhere. And I said to myself, thank you, Lord. So I turned the boat and I went over to this place, and it turned out to be the Cochran Hills Bible Camp. And when I pulled up to the shore, there was another boat there, aluminum boat, who had just come up from the Bering Sea. And it was a friend of mine. And I thought I was going to see him down when I got down to Emonic. And he says, oh, no, we come back early. So I got to see my friend, too. We spent the night there, and he brought some salmon up, and we had a great time with campfire. And I got to meet the people who run this camp, the Cochran Hills. You can edit that out. Right. Anyway, we're coming down river, and I ended up finding this Bible camp and also reuniting with a friend. And when we met the people that run it, it's the Cochran Hills Bible Camp's run by an Alaskan native. Their last name is Huntington. And wonderful folks. Well, I spent the night there with them. And the next morning we're having breakfast. And I asked them, I said, you wouldn't by chance be related to Sidney Huntington, would you? And the lady smiled and she says, that's my husband's father. So if you want to read an absolutely fascinating book, and I'm talking a really good book on Alaska, there's a book called Shadows of the Koyukuk. And the Koyukuk River is a river that feeds out of the Brooks Range. It comes down and meets with the Yukon. And it's about this Sidney Huntington. He was a man who he was a native, and he lived up there as a child, and his story is absolutely amazing. I won't tell you any more about it, but just look that book up. You will thoroughly enjoy reading that, and that'll give you a great taste of Alaskans and just how tough they are. Sydney was an amazing man, and the Huntington's great folks too there, Cochrane Hills Bible Camp. But anyway, as we started getting near the mouth of the river, you know, I was telling you it was getting wider and wider, and it's just a real challenge. And so we would run oxbows as much as we could, you know, side channels and things. But we finally, the last couple of days, it was just raining on us, just pouring and pouring. And I remember the day that I knew we were going to make the Bering Sea, I was really kind of bummed. I was thinking, you know, it'd be nice to be able to shoot some video and stuff and actually get some pictures. But this rain, we're not going to be able to do anything. So I was having to navigate around oyster beds and stuff through this rain downpour. And it was coming down hard. And I remember praying. I said, Lord, if it would please thee, I would love to see the sun when we reach the Bering Sea. And so we made the Bering Sea like probably 4 or 5 hours later. And we go out the mouth of it, and we hook up to the right. We pull up on the beach there where there's a bunch of whale bones and stuff. And it's just big tufts of grass and beautiful country. Very, very remote, windswept. And so we're enjoying, you know, our time there on the beach, having a beer. And I think Troy skipped down. He stripped down naked, went swimming, which is crazy. But and so Tim was running the drone and doing this and that. And all of a sudden, and it's really, you know, it's very dark and very cloudy all around us and windy. And all of a sudden, the clouds parted. And the sun shined on an area, a radius around us that was maybe, you know, 200 or 300 yards, a circle that shined down on us. I looked all around us. There was no other sun anywhere else. And that sun shined on us for about 3 or 4 minutes. And then the clouds closed up and it was gone. God. And yeah, a trip like that, there were so many times I saw the Lord's hands in it. And when you get out under the stars like that and you live like that, where you're not in control, you really develop a very healthy respect for nature and also, you know, a dependence on the Lord, too, because you ain't going to make it by yourself. You do a trip like that, you won't make it by yourself if you don't, you know, put some trust in Him. But it was strange coming back because, you know, I camped on the way back home as well, coming back down. I got back down to Anchorage and stayed with a buddy, and we did some salmon fishing and stuff. And then I was waiting for my gear because my gear had to be flown back from Immonic on a C-130, mm-hmm. and my motors and everything. So we flew that back to it was a backhaul, so it wasn't expensive. Usually it's expensive to transport any kind of gear into the bush, mm-hmm. but coming out of the bush are usually coming empty. So if they're coming out, it's super cheap to haul stuff out. But sleeping out under the stars for 2 months, when I got home, it was really strange sleeping inside.
It sounds like a really rough way to spend 2 months, if you ask me. I don't know that I could do that.
It was amazing. Yeah. You know, I stopped in Nebraska and saw Troy because he had already flown back. So I stopped and saw him and had dinner with his family. And we're sitting at the dinner table and he says, "So John, would you do it again?" And I looked at him and I said, "Why the hell would I want to do it again? I've already done it." And he started laughing. He said, "That's exactly how I answered the guys at work when they asked me the same question." He said, "Why would I want to do it again?" But I'm glad I done it. You know, we're really glad we did it. It was an amazing experience. Even now, there's sometimes I'll wake up in the middle of the night and I'm some spot on that river.
Yeah.
About.
Yeah, man. Well, let's do this. I told everybody at the beginning of this podcast that this would be one of those that we weren't able to cover everything. And as we sit, I believe we have a 2-hour long podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I can't believe we've been talking that long.
Yep. No, I just looked over. It's 9:49. We hit go at right about 8.
Oh, wow.
So I have got my hands full with an edit here, but I want to give you an opportunity. Circling uh-huh. back to Swamp Runner.
Uh-huh.
Give me the elevator pitch. Why should everyone in Florida with a narrow, long boat be running your system?
Well, it's the best motor. It's the best mud motor ever built. I'm not taking credit for me on that. All the credit goes to Song Sok Sweeper Cert Ying, the guy that started this in 1957. It's a tried and true system that, has cut its teeth in the jungles of Southeast Asia. It's a third world motor for third world conditions. The Yukon River is filled with glacial silt. Glacial silt is new sand. It's like razor blades. It's very sharp. So the guys up there that fish that river with outboards, they carry packs and packs of seals with them, because that river eats up their seals on their outboards just right and left. They constantly have to change them out. But the Swamp Runner, it doesn't matter. There are no seals. It doesn't care. So it's the ideal motor for that situation. It's so easy to work on. I could tear a Swamp Runner down on a gravel bar with minimal tools in probably about 30 minutes. Down to its very smallest parts, and then put it all back together and then go again. You can work on it anywhere. You don't have to have, a lot of special tools. Matter of fact, my little box that I carry in my boat all the time is a little Tupperware dish. It's about, I'd say it's about 10 inches long by about 6 inches wide by about 2 inches high. And I can fit everything in that box that I need to work on a motor out in the middle of nowhere.
That's awesome, man. I'm excited. I'm really excited. This spring, I'm gonna be doing a bunch of fiberglass work, redoing the benches, putting new foam in the boat to make it safe. Might even modify the center bench to get rid of some of that space to where I can walk through it and reinforce the sides. Once I'm done with that, it's time to build a motor. Time to get it going. Pretty much what I'm saying is, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you're getting to places where you don't see people, get ready. There's going to be a ginger hobbit flying around with a gnu and a Swamp Runner coming to an isolated location near you. Cause right now I'm paddling into those spots and it works. But we're going to be more efficient here soon.
Sounds good.
All right, buddy. So guys, here's the deal. That's a long podcast. I know that's a long podcast. But I think the whole story as a whole helps build a picture for why I had him on the show. This isn't just some guy out there making a profit. This isn't some company making a product. There is a guy with a story. There's a lifelong Floridian here. And I knew some of this as we've gone. I knew about the glacial silt. I knew about the bushings that he has. And I knew that all those stories would help paint a picture of a reliable option. And I want to give back to Florida brands. And so we had the option to have a bunch of people on. But it only seemed right that we had John on. So, dude, I want to extend a huge thank you from all of our listeners for taking, we've got to be like at 3 hours now between all the times that we've talked, trying to record a podcast, having actually recorded the podcast, and hopefully we answered some questions. And I'd be willing to bet there's going to have to be a part two at some point in time, because this is going to generate a dialogue. There's going to be more questions that come up, and I think we're going to have to put them all together and do a Q&A or something.
Walt, it's been a ball. I've really enjoyed it. I can't believe we've been talking this long. You told me. I thought we were about 45 minutes to an hour. But I love talking about long tails. I can talk about them all day long. And if you call our shop, Steve's even worse. He is off the phone.
I may call Steve just to talk to him whenever I'm doing my build. I bet you he's got something up his sleeve that he could.
You better have plenty of time if you call, because He will talk to you as long as you want to talk.
All right, yeah. Man, I appreciate it.
Well, hey, I enjoyed it.